Vedanta. You know, he took sannyas. He took sannyas. But from a Mayavadi. And he accepted Mayavad sannyas. Yeah. But not like on the level of his heart and, you know, where he was at. No. But it was a trick. It was a trick. Because in those days, people didn't take Vaishnav seriously. There was Vaishnav sannyas. And there were Vaishnav sannyasis. Like Ishvara Puri. He was a Vaishnav sannyasi, actually. And a very nice devotee. But generally, he and others like him, Vaishnav sannyasis, were not taken seriously. But the Mayavadis, they were taken very seriously. So Lord Chaitanya, he had been a householder, and people didn't take him very seriously, because, at least in India, householder devotees wouldn't be taken the same as sannyasi devotees. It's a big difference. Sannyasis are offered a lot more respect, even if they may not be more advanced than a householder devotee. So Lord Chaitanya, thinking that if they offer me respect, they will benefit, then he accepted sannyas, Mayavad sannyas, so they would respect him, even though it was like unintentional on their part. But even though it was indirect, they would benefit spiritually. Yeah, it's an interesting story how Lord Chaitanya took sannyas. I think I told it at Gopanim, did I? In the tent. When he took sannyas, that they wanted him to shave his head. He had to shave his head. He had long hair, very long hair, and very beautiful hair. So they said, okay, you know, you've got to shave your head now. And Lord Chaitanya said, fine. But then all the devotees who'd come, they were saying, no, no, you've got such beautiful hair, don't cut your hair off, please. Lord Chaitanya was saying, nope, I'm going to shave my head. Call the barber. So they called the barber. All the devotees were crying, falling on the ground, just overwhelmed that he's going to shave his head and his hair is so extremely beautiful. Then the barber came and he said, right, okay, here we go. And then he looked at the hair and he said, no, I don't think I can do this. And Lord Chaitanya was saying, no, come on, shave my head. Shave my head, I'm taking the sannyas. And all the devotees were just lamenting. And the barber was saying, well, you know, I don't think I can, but okay, I'll try. So he would pick up the scissors with shaking hands and drop them and fall on the ground and get up again with the scissors to cut Lord Chaitanya's hair and drop the scissors and faint. It was just too much. And in the end, it said that he was crying. He was cutting Lord Chaitanya's hair bit by bit and he was crying and fainting in between cuts. And even the scissors were crying. The scissors were crying. And then when Lord Chaitanya shaved his head, then Keshav Bharati told him, all right, now I'll give you the sannyas mantra. Because these initiations involve being given mantras. It's sort of like the internal part of the initiation. Like, first initiation you get Hare Krishna mantra. Second initiation you get the Gayatri mantras. So there's also mantras given at the time of sannyas. So Keshav Bharati told him, okay, now I'm going to give you the mantra. Come closer, and I'll whisper it in your ear, because no one else can hear. But it was a Mayavadi mantra. So he leant over to Lord Chaitanya to speak in his right ear. And Lord Chaitanya said, you know, sorry, I just didn't hear properly. Will you just lean a little closer? So Keshav Bharati leant right over against his ear and said the mantra into his ear. And Lord Chaitanya said, you know, I just didn't hear properly. What was it you said? Was it like this? And then Keshav Bharati turned his right ear. It's the right ear the mantra has to go through. And Lord Chaitanya said, was it like this? Then Lord Chaitanya spoke Vaishnav sannyas mantra into Keshav Bharati's ear. And Keshav Bharati said, yes, yes, I think that sounds very good. So the deeper understanding is that actually that time Lord Chaitanya didn't really take Mayavad sannyas, but he actually gave Keshav Bharati Vaishnav sannyas. So, very tricky. See, it's very tricky business. All right, so let's take a break and we'll see you in 15 minutes. Srila Prabhupada Kirtan.
Okay, so now just to finish this section 3, we'll go through mantra 8. Try and go through quickly. We mentioned the point that the verse is stating, the word is pariyagat, must know in fact. So this verse is making it clear that the very elevated Mahabhagavat is directly perceiving Krishna, and directly perceiving Krishna in these specific terms, in terms of these various sort of aspects of his nature. He is the greatest. Now, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada explains the use of these terms or the implications of these terms. And it's interesting, so I'll just briefly point them out. So the first thing is that the Uttama Adhikari knows Krishna, has realized Krishna as the greatest. So in what sense the greatest? Well, Prabhupada mentions on page 59, his description is not like in the same order as they appear in the verse. The bottom of page 59, that last paragraph there, Prabhupada says that he explains basically that the Uttama Adhikari has realized the greatness of Krishna, or how Krishna is the greatest, and the effect is that he doesn't ask Krishna for any useless thing, like liberation, particularly Prabhupada mentions. And Prabhupada says, he's not like a beggar, give us this day our daily bread, that idea which we've on umpteen dozen occasions made, sort of laughed about, or give me a house and a car and a color TV. What comes next? Om Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Anyway, pardon us for that, but I don't know how many hundred times I've said that, but everyone seems to. It's very appropriate. Yeah, so he's the greatest. He's the greatest of all. So you don't go to him, the Uttama Adhikari doesn't go with some petty thing. Prabhupada says here that a person who's begging like that, give me a new color TV, please, God, or something of that sort, then he has to continue eternally begging. Because when you get your new color TV, that's not sufficient, for eternal life, full of bliss and knowledge. Won't even do for the rest of this life. So, in this sense, it's very interesting, actually, how Prabhupada's applying these ideas. Very interesting. How the devotee, the very advanced devotee, is perceiving Krishna as the greatest, and therefore he's responding and acting in certain ways. Yeah. Doesn't just ask for some useless thing, or some, not even useless thing, but something which isn't like the best. Yeah, because he knows he's the greatest, so he can give the best. So then the next is, he sees him as the personality of Godhead, yes. He sees him as being unembodied. Prabhupada explains this in the first paragraph on page 56. And Prabhupada again gives an interesting description of what that means. The idea is, it's right in the middle of that first paragraph. It is clearly stated here that he is unembodied, which means that there's no difference between his body and soul. If you are unembodied, then you must be within the body. But Krishna, his body and he are the same. So he's not embodied. He is the body. Just like your hand is not within your hand. It is your hand. So Krishna's body is him. They are the same. So in this sense, Prabhupada explains this idea of Krishna being unembodied. He doesn't need a body. He already is one. Whereas we are not. We need a body, at least as conditioned souls. So then we become embodied in different bodies in each lifetime. Then next is omniscient. Prabhupada doesn't really go into that so much. He doesn't really go into it so much about how Krishna's omniscient. But then beyond reproach, Prabhupada gives an interesting analysis. Let's just see. Yeah. Omniscient. Beyond reproach. That is on page 60. Prabhupada talks about how he is beyond reproach. It's right in the middle of the page. He danced with the gopis without social restriction and without reproach. No one could really say anything. People may try and say things, but they can't really. In fact, and Prabhupada goes on to establish this by saying that even someone like Lord Chaitanya worshipped the love of the gopis, worshipped the gopis, and offered them all respect as the most advanced and pure devotees. And Lord Chaitanya, he was a sannyasi, and that means, you know, he doesn't have any, sannyasis don't have anything to do with boyfriends and girlfriends and all that sort of idea. And what to speak of sannyasis generally, but Lord Chaitanya, he was the most extremely strict sannyasi. There was one time, Lord Chaitanya, he was absorbed in ecstasy, Krishna consciousness, and he heard one lady singing some nice Krishna conscious song. And she was singing it very nicely. And she was actually a very nice devotee, in fact, herself. And Lord Chaitanya appreciated how wonderful this is, very devotional and Krishna conscious. And he became so overwhelmed, he lost control of himself. He just went running to find that singer, to embrace that singer, and offer, you know, appreciation like that. But it was a woman. So Govinda, Lord Chaitanya's servant, he went running behind Lord Chaitanya, chasing after him, and grabbed him on the run and told him, "My lord, it's a woman." And Lord Chaitanya came back to his external consciousness and he told Govinda, "Oh, you saved my life. You saved me." So, anyway, Lord Chaitanya was most extremely rigid in his standards of renunciation. But here in the case of Krishna with the gopis, he thought this is the highest, the greatest. So Krishna's beyond reproach. And again, Prabhupada is such a nice example how to show how the Uttama Adhikari is appreciating, realizing Krishna in these special ways. Then next is, well, without veins, that's mentioned in the first paragraph to do with the unembodied idea. Then pure and uncontaminated. Prabhupada discusses that on the last page, page 60 and 61. Krishna is so pure. He is shuddham and apapavidham, antiseptic and prophylactic. What does prophylactic mean? Huh? Sorry? Can you speak up? I listen. Prophylactic? Preventative, or something like that, yeah. Antiseptic means that you cannot contaminate it. Anyway, this is the idea. This is the idea. He's so pure that you cannot contaminate him. But then again, he's so pure that he'll purify you. So it's like two levels or two types of being pure. Prabhupada explains here in the purport, like the sun. The sun associates with like a puddle, something like that, a puddle of dirty water. And the sun purifies the dirty water without becoming contaminated. But we, if we have contact with the puddle of dirty water, we'll become contaminated. If we dive into it or contact it, touch it in some way, we'll become contaminated. But the sun touches it and doesn't become contaminated, but purifies it also. So Krishna's like that. You can't contaminate him. When the devotees were first getting to know George Harrison, in fact, when George Harrison made his first visit to Bhaktivedanta Manor, I was there at the time, it was 1973, it was raining and there were puddles around of dirty water. And some of the devotees, being in this mood, like I mentioned, kind of Kanishta mood, and and being more, taking certain materialistic people more seriously than they really deserve from the Krishna conscious point of view. So some of the devotees were waiting. Wow, George Harrison's coming. Amazing. We're going to see George Harrison with our own eyes. So they were waiting, and he came. He drove up in the rain. So one devotee, one of these devotees, was sort of waiting around. He said, wow, George Harrison just got out of his car. Amazing, unbelievable. So he offered his obeisances. But he actually offered his dandavats, splash, right in a puddle. And he got up sort of dripping and dirty. And George Harrison said, well, you know, you didn't really have to do that. Now, there are many stories. Well, we haven't got time to tell them all. So anyway, Krishna is Shuddham and Apapavidam. He's very pure. You can't contaminate him even if you try. And he's so pure that he'll disinfect you like this. So then next is that he's a self-sufficient philosopher. This is described on page 60. He is self, up at the top there you see, sixth line down, that paragraph beginning there. Only the Supreme Lord is self-sufficient. Oh, Prabhupada gives such a nice, this is very amazing what Prabhupada explains this. When Lord Krishna appeared on earth 5,000 years ago, he displayed his full manifestation as the personality of Godhead through his various activities. In his childhood, he killed many powerful demons, such as Agasura, Bakasura, and Shakarasura. And there was no question of his having acquired such power through any extraneous endeavor. He didn't have to go out of his way to get himself together so he could do that, because he's self-sufficient. And then the point that I really appreciate very much, Prabhupada says, he lifted Govardhan Hill without ever practicing weightlifting. Yes, quite true. No, Prabhupada, so clever, it's just amazing. Say something very humorous, but in a very serious context, it's kind of interesting contrast. Yeah, so yeah, he didn't practice weightlifting. He didn't have to learn kung fu or, you know, all that sort of stuff. He just did it because he's just like that. He's fully qualified, self-sufficient. And finally, he's been fulfilling everyone's desire since time immemorial. That's discussed on page 58. See, we're sort of jumping around here and there. So Prabhupada here, this is now halfway down page 58. In this mantra, as well as in many other Vedic mantras, it is clearly stated that the Lord has been supplying goods to the living entities from time immemorial. So then Prabhupada goes on to explain, and the main point he makes is that most people don't know what to ask. Actually, this is one of Krishna's main businesses with the conditioned souls, fulfilling desires. But the people don't know what to desire, so they desire the wrong thing. And when you desire the wrong thing, you get the wrong result and your life becomes all wrong. And so this is going on. So in Krishna consciousness particularly, we have to be careful what we desire. Because Krishna will probably fulfill your desire. And if you desire the wrong thing, you'll get into the wrong situation and you'll get into trouble. So we have to be very careful. You know, there are amusing little stories that Prabhupada told about people desiring the wrong thing. I'm sure you've heard the one about the lady collecting the wood in the forest, right? That's a well-known story. She would make her living by going and collecting firewood and coming out and selling it. And one day she got kind of lost in the forest and too much wood, and night was falling and she was still in the forest. She fell over, dropped all the wood and called out, "Oh, Krishna, help!" And Krishna appeared and said, "Yes, what do you want?" So she was thinking, "What do I want? Gosh." Then she thought, "Oh, yes." She told Krishna, "Would you please pick up the wood and put it back on my head?" So Srila Prabhupada told that story. It's very typical. That's a very silly thing. She could have asked Even if she was just an ordinary materialistic person, she could have said, well, let me become Lord Brahma, or, you know, become a multi-zillionaire, something like that. So, you know, she could have asked for that, but she was really stupid. So, I mean, it's like stupid, and they're different levels. So she was fully qualified in stupidity. But the devotee is intelligent, so the devotee does not ask to become Lord Brahma even, which would have been more intelligent for that lady. But the devotee asks, what does the devotee ask for? Yes, devotional service, I suppose you could say. Prabhupada says here that, this is on page 59, right at the top, when the living being comes to know his constitutional position, however, he asks to be accepted into the transcendental association of the Lord in order to render transcendental loving service unto him. So yes, to render devotional service, but even more like, you know, to that we can become good servants and really advance like this and become close associates, loving servitors of Krishna. We can develop love of God. So these then are the realizations that the Uttama Adhikari has, and, you know, they're very remarkable realizations, actually, if you think about them. Very remarkable. Not just like some common man's philosophical idea of what God may be, but very interesting and very profound realizations, perceptions that the first class devotee has. So now we go on to the next section, starting with mantra 9. We're not going to go through the whole thing right now, but what we're going to do, again, there are two sections, verses 9, 10, and 11, I mean subsections, goes from 9 to 14 altogether, but verses 9, 10, and 11 fit together into one subgroup, and then 12, 13, and 14 fit together into one subgroup. The way they do that is really quite extraordinary, very extraordinary. We'll talk more about that tomorrow, how they fit together. Of course, actually, we've mentioned it in the overview book, if you've happened to have read that. It's really quite amazing how these two subsections tie together. But for today, we're going to go through just the first subsection, which is 9, 10, and 11, and as usual, we'll recite the verses. So we're on page 63 here. Andam tamaha pravashanti.
Andam tamaha pravashanti.
Ye vidyam upasate.
Ye vidyam upasate.
Tato buya ivate tamo.
Tato buya ivate tamo.
Ya uvidya yamrita.
Those
who engage in the culture of nescient activities shall enter into the darkest region of ignorance. Worse still are those engaged in the culture of so-called knowledge. Okay, and then mantra 10, page 69. Anyad evahur vidyaya.
Anyad evahur vidyaya.
Anyad ahur avidyaya.
Anyad ahur avidyaya.
Iti shushruma diranam.
Iti shushruma diranam.
Yenastad vichachakshire.
Yenastad vichachakshire.
The wise have explained that one result is derived from the culture of knowledge, and that a different result is obtained from the culture of nescience. So that's kind of self-evident, really, but there's a rather interesting explanation behind that. We'll talk about that shortly. Then, page 75, mantra 11. Vidyam cha vidyam cha yas.
Vidyam cha vidyam cha yas.
Tad vedo vayam saha.
Tad vedo vayam saha.
Avidyaya mrityum tertva.
Avidyaya mrityum tertva.
Avidyaya mrityum ashnute.
Avidyaya mrityum ashnute.
Only one Who can learn the process of nescience and that of transcendental knowledge side by side, can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death, and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. So that's an interesting statement. So anyway, we'll discuss this all now. So Mantra 9, first of all, Mantra 9 is saying that those who engage in the culture of nescient activities shall enter into the darkest region of ignorance, and worse still are those engaged in the culture of so-called knowledge. Now, just to make it a little simpler, we've written up here on the verse just a little bit to elaborate. So, the first category, those who engage in the culture of nescient activities, they are class one. Can you read that?
Yes.
Up the back there, can you read that? You sure? So, they're just fools, mudhas, common garden fool, average run-of-the-mill fool, who just can't get it together in any way, materially, spiritually, he just can't get it together. So he's just your typical fool, doesn't really know what's going on. So that's very unfortunate. Mudha, we use this term mudha, ass-like person. So that's very unfortunate, and as the verse says, such a person enters into the darkest region of ignorance, which is a great shame. And the devotees, of course, often these people will be innocent. You know, they're generally not terribly intelligent, so there's a tendency for them to be innocent in that sense. But they're often innocent types of people, so the devotees like to help them, actually. We're not going to just stand there and say, oh, look at these fools. Just look at them, they're just fools. But we want to help them. They would generally be innocent. But now this other category, they're worse. They're definitely worse. Those people engaged in the culture of so-called knowledge. This means the materialistic intellectuals. And they would often tend to be more in the category, at least in terms of the Madhyama Adhikari description, of being like the atheists, and people are antagonistic to God consciousness. And in the purport, you'll see that Srila Prabhupada says there are two main types, Vedavada Rita and Mayaya Parita Jnana. Let's see, where is it? Well, Prabhupada begins talking, first of all, he talks in general about class two without discriminating between the Vedavada Rita and Mayaya Parita Jnana. He starts talking about people who are materialistic intellectuals. And normally, of course, people think that to have knowledge is a lot better than not having knowledge in material life. This is a very popular idea. That if people don't go to school and so on, then this is bad for them. But according to the idea presented here in Sri Ishapanishad, if you get too absorbed in this materialistic knowledge, which is antagonistic by nature to knowledge of Krishna consciousness, then this is worse than just being foolish and not knowing anything or not knowing very much. Prabhupada gives an interesting little example to illustrate on page 65. The sixth line, or actually starts the fourth line down from the top of the page. Prabhupada says, the advancement of learning by a godless people is as dangerous as a valuable jewel on the hood of a cobra. A cobra decorated with a valuable jewel is more dangerous than one not decorated. So to be an ignorant fool is like cobra. You know, you're in a bad situation. It's very bad. But when a person has so-called knowledge,
the advancement of learning by a godless people is as dangerous as a valuable jewel on the hood of a cobra. A cobra decorated with a valuable jewel is more dangerous than one not decorated. So to be an ignorant fool is like cobra. You know, you're in a bad situation. It's very bad. But when a person has so-called knowledge, and they think that, yes, you know, I know so much,
and I can really get it together in the material world and be a big success in the material world. And in this way they go deep into material existence. That's like a cobra, but with a jewel on the head. You may think, oh, very nice. Let me make friends. Let me get to know this cobra because of the jewel, being attracted by the jewel. So it's like that. So the cobra's bad enough, but when he's got a jewel on the head, he's worse. So this is the idea. Fools and those who are materialistic intellectuals. So better just to remain a fool than meant to be such a materialistic intellectual. You know, being materialistic intellectual means you become expert at getting into Maya. When you're a fool, you just get into Maya anyway because you don't know any better. But when you become a big expert in getting into Maya, oh, then you really get into Maya. Just like most people eat meat. But someone who's like this, the sort of big expert on meat eating, oh, he'll have all sorts of exotic meats and he'll really get into it. You know, some poor person who can't get a job because not well enough educated and so on. They may not be able to afford meat, but, you know, some big expert materialist, he'll make the most of it. You know, exotic meat eating, exotic sex life, exotic intoxication. He'll know all the latest intoxicants and, you know, like this. This is the idea. So anyway, then, Prabhupada, at the bottom of page 65, that paragraph beginning there, he says that there are two main categories, and we've written them on the board there. One is Veda Vada Rata. Actually, they're also referred to in Bhagavad Gita, also in very negative terms. So the way Prabhupada explains them, what they are is, they know the Vedas, or they have some Vedic knowledge at least, but it's all perverted and twisted, and you know, they try to exploit the Vedas. And their goal, as far as they're concerned, is to go to the heavenly planets. This is what they think the Vedas are all about. So they become, because they're very intelligent, they're intellectuals, so they become very knowledgeable in materialistic religion, and they even become gurus or whatever, like leaders in the field, and people follow them and they exploit those people. So in this way it's a whole perversion of the real Vedic culture. So that's Veda, Vada, Rita. Then the other type, the Maya Parita Jnana type, they're described on page 67, the last paragraph there. The Maya Parita Jnana class of men are self-made gods. Do-it-yourself avatarhood, something like that. Become your own avatar, something like that. So, no, it's really such an unfortunate situation. And, of course, in India it's rather popular to declare yourself God, and there are many people who would like to know God, but, you know, their standard for God is very low, so they may accept you. And in this way you get the cheaters and the cheated, and again, it's a whole perversion. But in order to successfully declare yourself God and fool sufficient people, you've got to have it together a bit. You've got to know a little magic. Or, you know, you've got to be able to speak with very sweet words and a nice smile and giggle a bit every now and then. I don't know, but you've got to be able to get it together at least and put on a good show. And then people, some simple people, the Mudha type, they will think, oh yeah, looks like God to me. And there you go. Away you go. So, it's a shame. Okay, so that's Mantra 9. Yeah. They are all candidates for going down. All of them. Then Mantra 10, the wise have explained that one result is derived from the culture of knowledge and that a different result is obtained from the culture of nescience. So as we said, this is pretty self-evident. No, it's, you don't have to be very bright
to understand that point. But the way, the real implication and the way Srila Prabhupada explains it, knowledge and ignorance, there is a difference, of course. But that's not really the point. It's not really the point. The point is that there is a difference between the culture of knowledge and the culture of nescience. This is the point. And that is rather profound. So it's not just a matter of reading lots of books and drumming a lot of information into your head and in that way becoming knowledgeable as opposed to someone who doesn't do that and who's ignorant. It's a matter of culture. Culture. And Srila Prabhupada explains this in a very interesting and important way by referring to Bhagavad Gita chapter 13, verses 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. Those of you who study Bhagavad Gita a bit would know those verses. They're very important verses. Krishna lists out a whole lot of things and says that these things make up knowledge. And anything else makes up ignorance. But it's not so much like we said in the academic sense you must read lots of books like that. It's a culture. It's a culture. And without that culture, reading lots of books won't really work in producing a person who's actually qualified. So let's just go through the different points then which Prabhupada has taken out of those verses from chapter 13. So first is, number one, bottom of page 69, once you become a perfect gentleman and learn to give proper respect. So the Sanskrit, in fact, in Bhagavad Gita is amanitvam. Amanitvam. Humility. Now you might ask, a materialist person would ask, what has humility got to do with knowledge? Now knowledge means you read lots of books like that. But here Krishna is saying that the first part of knowledge, or the culture of knowledge, that way of life, by culture we mean way of life and sort of personal development, the first part is you become humble. The first part. Otherwise, even though you read lots of books, you end up actually in nescience. So first part is humility. Then second, you shouldn't pose yourself as a religionist simply for name and fame. Three, one shouldn't become a source of anxiety for anyone. Non-violence, in fact. This is non-violence. This is actually what Krishna said, ahimsa. In Bhagavad Gita, in these verses, ahimsa. You have to be non-violent if this is part of the culture of knowledge. And four, you should be tolerant. You have to be very tolerant. This is an essential part of the culture of knowledge. Then five, you should be simple, straightforward, honest. Otherwise, you can't cultivate knowledge. And six, one should find a bona fide spiritual master. Well, that's more kind of directly related to knowledge. You know, you can learn from a bona fide spiritual master. But again, the idea of the culture, the point is that culture of knowledge is not a do-it-yourself process. Go down to the CNA and buy a book about how to become a pure devotee. And a few weeks later, you are one. You know? No. As part of the culture, you have to approach a spiritual master. Otherwise, it won't work. You will not come out as a knowledgeable person. Seven. You have to follow regulative principles. You have to be self-controlled, in other words. Eight. You have to follow scripture. Nine. Refrain from practices detrimental to the interest of self-realization. You have to be focused on the goal. 10. You have to not accept more than you need. No extravagance. Simple living and high thinking. And number 11, don't identify with the body. 12, this is in those verses, Krishna says, dukkha dosha nidarshanam. You have to be convinced about birth, death, old age and disease, how they're no good. You have to be convinced about that. 13. Again, know just the necessities of life. Keep things simple. 14. Don't be attached to your family and all the various comforts that are involved with that. 15. Don't be attached to happiness, distress, victory, defeat. 16. You've got to be a devotee. 17. Don't be attached to living in a certain environment, but be more concerned with what will be conducive for Krishna consciousness. And 18, you have to actually study real knowledge, spiritual knowledge. Of course, that's more directly related to knowledge as such. But the point is that to become a knowledgeable person means to become a pure devotee. You don't just read lots of books and become a first-class Krishna conscious person. There's a culture. So this is why in Krishna consciousness, for example, we insist you must follow the regulative principles. At least you must follow them if you are thinking of actually becoming a proper Krishna conscious person. I mean, you can sort of carry on. We don't mind, in a sense, if people don't follow the regulative principles, but they come to the temple and they sort of, you know, get involved a bit. You know, we're not going to persecute anyone if they're not following the regulative principles. But they are not going to actually become knowledgeable in this sense, the real sense, which means that their life is going to be transformed and they'll become perfect persons. So there's a big difference then between the culture of knowledge and the culture of nescience. And in fact, to illustrate culture of nescience, Prabhupada talks about going to a university or a place like M.L. Sultan. Don't tell the authorities we said that, but... You know, they would say, oh, it's the culture of knowledge. But no. It's the culture of nescience. Yeah. You come to the tech... And I suppose it's like most universities and so-called places of higher education. There's all sorts of parties going on and drinking and smoking marijuana and all that, boyfriends and girlfriends. And I did a program in a school in New York a couple of years ago, high school. And when we walked in, they had different notice boards, this huge place. Notice boards as we're walking into the classroom. So one was, are you feeling suicidal? Phone this number. Okay, thanks. If I get like that, I will. So next one was, are you pregnant? Phone this number. Then a little further on, are you addicted to drugs? Phone that number. You know, like this. There it is, in the high school, big posters. So it's meant to be the culture of knowledge. You know, it's knowledge maketh man, they say, but actually you need the real culture of knowledge. Otherwise it may be knowledge in a certain sense of the term, but it's actually part of the culture of nescience. You follow the idea? That's a very interesting point, very interesting way Prabhupada explains it. As usual. And of course he says you have to learn in the third line, he says iti shushruma dhiranam. You learn this from the dhiras, the renounced people, the undisturbed, sober people. Dhira really means sober, undisturbed, like that. So you can learn from those people and not the adhiras, those who just have book knowledge or the politicians, or mundane educators like that. Okay, so let's go on to Mantra 11. And Mantra 11 makes an interesting point, that if you want to actually transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality, you have to learn the process of nescience and the process of transcendental knowledge side by side. So you might think, well, we should just learn the process of transcendental knowledge and forget about this nescience. Because, you know, who needs nescience? But actually, the speaker is saying that you need to understand nescience and transcendental knowledge, naturally, if you're actually going to become successful and go back to Godhead, become a perfect Krishna-conscious person. This is an integral part of the Ishavasya system. So, naturally, to learn transcendental knowledge means to understand Krishna consciousness, Krishna conscious philosophy. That is pretty obvious. To learn nescience, what does this mean? You have to have knowledge. You have to learn the process of nescience. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada talks about it in two senses. One sense is that you have to understand what is wrong with material life. You have to learn the process of nescience. You have to know what's wrong with birth, death, old age, and disease. What's wrong with identifying with the body? What's wrong with getting entangled in family life or materialistic advancement? You have to learn that. So that's the process of nescience. You've got to learn the process of nescience. And on the other hand, and Prabhupada talks about this on page 80 mainly. As far as understanding the defects of material life is concerned, on page about, what? Page 76. Actually, Prabhupada goes on for a few pages, 76, 77, 78, talking all about Hiranyakashipu. This is in regard to understanding the defects of material life. That Hiranyakashipu, as materialists go, he was the number one materialist. If anyone was ever going to get their material life together, it was Hiranyakashipu. But he failed. He failed completely and he lost everything. And even in the meantime, he was always disturbed and distressed. Even though he had the whole universe at his fingertips. So in this way, Prabhupada is illustrating the first of these two points, that material life is defective. You know, if Hiranyakashipu couldn't get it together, then how on earth are you going to get it together? You know, be serious. Don't think that, well, Hiranyakashipu made that mistake. And I'm not going to make that mistake, you know, not me. I'll get it together and be a success in material life. Then, as far as the second point, making the best use of a bad bargain, we said page 80. Prabhupada talks about that. That, you know, we understand that this material world is no good. We don't want to get entangled. We don't want to get involved. We want to be very Krishna conscious, but still we have these material bodies. And, you know, you can't just forget about them. They're there. And we are living in them. So, what do? We make the best use of a bad bargain. So this is the second part of learning the process of nescience. Learning how to make the best use of a bad bargain without getting entangled. You can be a family person, but not be entangled. And in that way, your family situation can be conducive for Krishna consciousness. You can be a business person or, you know, whatever it may be, within reason. And utilize it in Krishna consciousness, being very careful at the same time, making the best use of a bad bargain. So you need both. If you don't have both, if you have only knowledge of Krishna only, and you don't understand the defects of material life and all these things, then what happens to you? You become a sahajiya. You become a sahajiya. If you don't understand what is wrong with material life, if you don't understand that you're not this body, you become a sahajiya, one who takes Krishna cheaply. And if you don't have knowledge of Krishna, but you just have lots of knowledge of nescience, you know, you understand you're not your body, and how the material world is very bad and all that sort of thing, then what do you end up as? What do you think? No knowledge of Krishna, but very good knowledge of nescience. Huh? Someone speak up? Well, you become an impersonalist. Yeah, you become an impersonalist. So without both, it's like Prabhupada one time, in illustrating exactly this point, how you need both. Knowledge of Krishna plus knowledge of nescience. Prabhupada said it's like a train running on two tracks. And if you take one of the tracks out, either one, then you've got a crash. So it's like that. Even knowledge of Krishna. In India there are many people, they like Krishna very much, but they don't understand they're not this body. They think they are this body. And they think that material life is quite nice. And Krishna danced with the gopis, and that's nice. And I'll do the same thing. Yeah, actually it's a fact. So they have knowledge of Krishna, but they don't have this knowledge of nescience. So they end up sahajiyas. And then, of course, there are plenty of impersonalists who don't know about Krishna, but who know they're not this body and they're very renounced and very staunch like that. So this is really what is being discussed here in Mantra 11. And as we said, mantras 12, 13 and 14 are parallels. They're parallels to mantras 9, 10 and 11. And it's like they're more explaining more explicitly, really, the same thing. In fact, the wording in some of the mantras is almost exactly the same in the actual Sanskrit. So we'll talk about that tomorrow morning. Oh, Shamla, very good. What's your question? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Well, that's a good question. One of those principles in the culture of knowledge was that you have to accept a bona fide spiritual master and inquire from him. And we said this is, at least in certain respects, more directly related with knowledge as such. So, Shamlal Prabhu's question is, what happens if you have a spiritual master and you serve him? Yes? Anyway, you're carrying on, but you're not inquiring. You're not asking questions. Well, the relationship, of course it depends, like Srila Prabhupada said, that he only ever asked his spiritual master one question. How can I serve you? So the thing is that otherwise, all the other questions, Prabhupada already knew the answer. Yeah, so he didn't have to just, you know, for the sake of asking questions, to put on a good show, he didn't just go through the motions of asking questions. He already knew. But that thing, how can I serve you, he really wanted to know very clearly. So he asked. Then, but anyway, in our case, it's not like that. We should know, how can I serve you? That we should ask. And then we should do it when we find out. But there are many things, obviously, that we don't understand. And it applies to all of us, so many things, actually. So we should ask questions. Not just should, we have to. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, in 434, I hope you all know 434, he says, pari prashnena sevaya. There has to be prashna, questions, and seva. Not just questions with no seva, and not just seva with no questions, unless you already know everything. But, you know, we don't. So if one just serves and doesn't ask questions, then one's position won't be so strong. Yeah, that's only natural. Because if there's certain things you don't know, then because Krishna consciousness is a very practical process, it's not just purely academic, you know, like learning chemistry or something like that. Half the stuff, you're not going to, it's not practical. It's just, you know, some theoretical knowledge. But Krishna consciousness is a scientific process of how to live. It manifests ultimately in your life. So if there's certain things you don't know, sooner or later, the aspect of your life that knowledge relates to is going to manifest, but you won't have the knowledge, so you won't be able to deal with it. You follow the idea? Yeah. You won't be able to deal with certain things. Yeah. So that will be the result. And as a result, one's position will become shaky. Yeah. And one may fall down eventually. So both things have to be there. On the other hand, you know, just asking questions, loads of questions. I've met people like that. You know, just hundreds or dozens of questions on and on and on about even, you know, the most technical, subtle points which are even hardly relevant in some cases. But then where the service? No service. Or, you know, hardly any service. So it also doesn't work. Yeah, so both things have to be there. Yeah. Of course, the spiritual master may be like in a sort of physical or geographical sense, distant. But still one should try and inquire by writing like that. Yeah. Any other question? Yes, Mataji? Mm-hmm. Okay, one should develop a liking for residence in a secluded place, right? Yeah. Right. Would tend to suggest that. Yeah, well, it's yes and no. It's not actually, but it might appear to be like that. It means, secluded place means where there's no materialistic people. So you should develop a liking for that. And there may be many devotees, like here where we are now, we would say this is probably one of the most secluded places in Durban right now. But, you know, we have 100 people here in one room. But in the context of this concept, this is really how we should understand it. We don't want to mix with the materialistic people. And we hanker to be in a situation where we don't have to, but we can associate with the devotees and Krishna like this. So it's more like this. And Prabhupada says, that one should develop a liking for residence in a secluded place with a calm and quiet atmosphere, favorable for spiritual culture. And one should avoid congested places where non-devotees congregate. So it's really, that is the real sense, where the non-devotees congregate. Yeah. Of course, you know, you can also say that sometimes when you're with the devotees, it gets a bit intense. Yeah, sometimes it does. Some devotees sometimes at least can get a little intense. So sometimes, you know, to have a little peace and quiet for yourself so you can chant properly without being interrupted and so on by other devotees even. It may also be appropriate. So there is a place for like a certain element of seclusion and actual quietness in a very literal sense. However, as a general rule, we'd understand it to mean, you know, no non-devotees secluded like that. Like Prabhupada